Hi and welcome to episode 55 of the Guru Performance We Do Science podcast. And today I'm very pleased to welcome back Eric Helms. Hi, Eric.
Hello, welcome. Thank you for having me back. It's an honor.
I think what happened there is because you're based in New Zealand, because I know the accent's going to confuse people, but rather than being on the internet, I welcomed you via a pigeon that we sent to New Zealand and back, hence the delay there. There was an uncomfortable silence. Oh dear. Okay, so a lot of the listeners, I hope, have been listening to this podcast from the start. As I just said, it's episode 55, so there's a lot of episodes for people to get through. I'm hoping people think that I'm pumping out quality rather than just quantity here. But in that quantity of podcasts, you, of course, have featured with Alan Aragon, and we got into nutrition for bodybuilding contest prep, and that was a very popular episode, and today I don't want to go over the same material, but I do want to focus on a topic which inevitably will delve into that and other topics that other podcasts got into, which is namely the sort of this concept of body composition and why body composition is important, not so much from the perspective of elite athletic performance, and I have actually touched upon that in various other podcasts, but for the more common reason for desiring body composition, which is perhaps more to do with the aesthetics of it, which is of course essential for those getting into physique preparation and bodybuilding and so on. But before we sort of get into that and explore, you know, what body composition is, rather than just weight and weight loss, weight gain, but also how, you know, to get there based on an evidence-based or evidence-informed approach. Just in case listeners aren't aware of who you are, Eric, do you want to just give us a quick introduction as to who you are and what you're currently up to, and then we'll get into it.
For sure, yeah. I like to describe myself as someone who fell in love with lifting heavy things about 11 years now, and quickly found myself falling in love with not only the practice of lifting, but also the science behind it, and then the sports of natural competitive bodybuilding and raw powerlifting. And I tend to be rather uber focused in my pursuits, the things that I'm passionate about. So very quickly, this became my career, academically and in terms of my actual career, as well as being an athlete. I formed 3D Muscle Journey in 2009 after having been a personal trainer for 5 or 6 years at that point, I believe, maybe 4 or 5 years. And that's with my fellow natural pros, Alberto Nunez, Brad Loomis, and Jeff Alberts, and I've also been pursuing my academics. And at this stage, I'm about a year and a half into my PhD in strength and conditioning, and I'm at the Auckland University of Technology here in New Zealand, as you mentioned. And I have a master's degree, essentially in sports nutrition. It's a master's of philosophy, and my thesis topic was on energy restriction in strength athletes. I did a master's in the States on exercise science as well, and in the process of publishing a number of papers both in the areas of strength and conditioning and sports nutrition, typically related to strength and or physique athletes, just loving the science and loving helping people.
No, that's awesome, and you know, like I said, we've done a podcast before where we reviewed one of the papers that you've put out, which is in JRSSN, the evidence-based recommendations for natural bodybuilding contest prep, nutrition and supplementation, with Alan Aragon and Peter Fitchin. And I recommend the listeners to go look at that at JRSSN. It's actually the currently the most popular paper on JRSSN, Eric. So yeah, you're producing some pop research there. my team at Guru Performance, we recently published a case study of the same title, more or less, evidence-based a nutrition intervention for the same scenario. And it's clearly getting interesting, and there just isn't much research out there. I mean, I guess let's explore that just quickly, because lots of people have strong opinions about, nutrition and training interventions for physique preparation and bodybuilding, and just getting that physical look that people are after, that we'll get into on this body composition conversation. But before we do that, could you just give us a quick overview as to where we are with the actual published research in that area?
Oh, we're Stone Age, man. So it is. It's interesting that people have such strong views, because I would think an evidence-based viewpoint at this stage would be one that is has an element of humility, if you will. I think we did a pretty good job in both of our training and nutrition-based papers on this topic of hedging our bets, only speaking on things that we have a decent amount of evidence to back, not overstating the claims, giving leeway for individual variability, and also, saying that, this is the beginning. There's a lot of limitations to this research, and stating them pretty clearly. So now that said, there's a tremendous amount of in the trenches experience, and that will get you a variety of different recommendations depending on who you talk to. And I don't think anecdotal information is useless, but certainly in terms of the hierarchy of quality information, it's not like we're at the stage where we can produce a meta-analysis or we even have RCTs. I think your guys' publication was the third case study, so now we have N equals three,
That's nothing.
Yeah. That said, there are a handful of studies on natural bodybuilders out there. There's a study on women by Van der Ploeg, and there's another one by Maestu, and I'm sure I'm slaughtering that last name. There might be another observational one out there. So, if it exists, I've probably read it, but that doesn't take that much time, to be honest. So I would say we're at a stage where we have very little information on this, but lots of dieting information on obese people and lots of performance information on athletes, and somewhere you can kind of, well, we did basically try to get the closest approximation of an evidence-based approach as possible at this stage. And I would like to say that myself, Alan, and Peter, and also Brad and John Cronin, who helped on the training paper, we would like to update our recommendations, every few years as more research is done.
Yeah, no, that's gonna be exciting to read it. And that's why we wanted to do the case study that we did. We're going to do a podcast about that soon. There is a difference, of course, between what we're learning from the academics and all the systematic reviews, the meta-analyses, that sort of thing. And actually, okay, well, let's just actually put it into practice, and let's try and observe this properly and see what happens. And of course, you may not get everything perfect. As I have come to realize from our study, it's bloody difficult to research, and it's very difficult to control variables. And my hats go off to the guys that do the bigger studies. I mean, it's difficult. But the reason why I'm interested in this, Eric, is it's not so much for professional bodybuilders or for those that are looking to somehow heavily invest themselves in getting from where they are at whatever point to being on stage wearing virtually nothing with a rather dodgy tan. That of course is sort of that's the ultimate application of this, but there are a lot of people out there who one way or the other are still trying to do the same thing, albeit not stand on stage, but they are trying to get themselves to a position where they can, walk around on a beach or go on holiday, stand by the pool, or just, for want of a better phrase, look better naked. Okay, and and we're talking the same thing. It's an aesthetic thing. Whether you're being judged professionally or whether you're being judged by your peers, whether you're being judged by the opposite sex. You know, it's the same thing. We're trying to achieve this concept of an ideal body composition, which of course people have different ideas as to what that is, which is one thing I want to get into. But I think that we should start this conversation off by making something clear, and that is that whatever we get into and whatever discussions people have about what it takes to achieve optimal body composition, it's not necessarily the same thing as what it takes to achieve optimal health. And I find that interesting mm-hmm. too. You know, the you hear a lot in nutrition, and there's a lot of research that sort of you see arguments for, you know, whether we should eat X amount of vegetables or whether we should achieve a certain level of certain vitamins or minerals or whatever for health purposes. But that isn't necessarily the same thing for body composition. And you know, whatever it takes to get you onto stage or to look amazing isn't necessarily the same thing that it takes to get you healthy. Now, of course, you can potentially achieve them together. But when people debate this stuff, they're not usually talking about this from the health perspective. They're just, you know, if we become more outcome focused in our approach to this, it gets interesting. So I guess let's define body composition a bit then, Eric. So rather than talking about weight gain and weight loss and let's bulk up or whatever, why do you think maybe we should use the word body composition more?
Well, I think simply put, it delineates between the different compartments of the body. You know, I think the primary ones that get focused on that are the easiest to measure is the two compartment model, where you have your lean body mass and then your fat mass. And this is important for health, like you're talking about, because typically more fat free mass and lower fat mass is a great way to. It's probably a better way to define obesity or an unhealthy body composition rather than BMI, which has its shortfalls. That's body mass index. It's just a straight relationship between height and weight, regardless of body composition. But body composition is probably much more indicative of your risk state for, what we might call lifestyle diseases, such as diabetes or heart disease and things like that. Being able to get a decent idea of where your body composition is can be a surrogate value for the future of your health, or if not your present health. It's the delineation between lean body mass and fat mass, and there are four compartment models where you can actually talk about minerals and the water and all that fun stuff. And there's multiple ways to do it. Some are accessible only to researchers, some are accessible to the lay public, some are reliable, some are highly unreliable.
Yeah. And I get a lot of people, when they get into this idea of manipulating body composition, usually there's an element of extremes involved. And, people can be very idealistic about this. They say, okay, well, what I want to do is gain muscle and lose fat. But that isn't necessarily such an easy thing to achieve, and of course what they want to do is gain muscle and lose fat at the same time, which is possible but again requires a certain approach. But what in the average person who is looking to improve their body composition, from your experience as someone who does actually coach people who do this to a very high level, where do you see people taking this the wrong way? Where are they making their biggest mistakes in terms of body composition?
Well, I think the big one is that almost everyone is attracted to the biggest immediate payoff rather than thinking of it as a lifestyle change that will be sustainable. You were mentioning earlier that optimal for body composition isn't necessarily the same thing as optimal for health. And I would put forth that in addition to that, optimal is not the same thing as sustainable. And this applies across both populations of people just more interested in health and looking good and feeling happy about their physical appearance, and competitive physique athletes, is that what will get you shredded and looking like you're ready to get on stage is not maintained by bodybuilders. And the kind of lighter version of that, of trying to look great on the beach and have a six-pack, that also needs to be thought of in a way that is sustainable. Now, you really shouldn't, nor you can't, sustain striated glutes year-round and 4% body fat as a male, you know, naturally and healthily, unless you've just got a 1 in a million genetics as far as your set point. But anyway, you can find a sustainable, happy body composition that you can get to. And I think too often people either want to shoot there too quickly, shoot past it, or get there in a way that they could never maintain it. Or even if they could, they're so burnt out on the approach they took by the time they get there that they will binge themselves right back to or past where they started.
And I've gotten into this a bit with various people that I've had on the podcast. Actually, we had Lane Norton and Abby Smith Ryan. We were talking about this, you know, this idea of metabolic adaptation, which is fascinating. I've had Alan on a few times, actually. We explored all sorts of areas, one of which was this whole concept of sustainability and are you actually able to stick, you know, compliance? Are you able to keep this up for a period of time? And of course, it's that ability to maintain a diet, I think, that is the tricky bit, of course, because it's like Lane Norton said when I was talking to him about this stuff, you know, it's easy enough to lose weight, but to keep it off is the issue, or body fat specifically. And that's where people tend to get into trouble, don't they? And I know, because I work with all sorts of clients, you know, a common scenario, and I'm not talking about professional athletes here, is they'll come in and say, look, you know, I've got a wedding next week, or I'm going on holiday, and as you referred to the six pack on the beach, you know, they'll be, look, in a month I'm going to be going on holiday with my mates, and I want to have that six pack. You know, that people have these short term goals that they want to achieve with a short term strategy, but they're not looking at a long term strategy that necessarily that they can maintain. So, I mean, if we get into this idea of an optimal body composition from a more aesthetic perspective, perhaps you could describe what that ideal would be, and then we can talk about those various components and how we get there and a bit of the science behind it.
What people think is the aesthetic ideal?
Yeah. I mean, when we talk about optimal body composition,
Well, you know, to be honest, optimal body composition is, if it's aesthetic, it's totally defined by the person. You know, it's what they want to look like. And if we talk about optimal for health, then you have a broader range. Pretty much if you're below, you know, 20% body fat for men, you're probably fine, and below 30% for women in terms of, you know, health risk. But I think that's a really good question, is because there are people who are never happy with the way they look. You know, anorexics, for example, want to be so lean that they can't live sometimes. And I address a lot of eating disorders with my clients sometimes, which is a common thing to happen among physique competitors, because they don't have maybe a realistic goal for what is sustainable, what they want to look like long term, or they want to look like they look like on stage all year round. And you know, I'm not saying that's really relevant to your question, but I want to point out that it's highly subjective. You know, what someone thinks is aesthetic is going to be dictated by their culture, their age, and you know, their personal preferences. So, you know, I'm sure someone who is, you know, 400 pounds and has been obese all their life would simply dislike to be not overweight. While someone who has been skinny their whole life would like to look more muscular, and everywhere in between. So, I think the point that you probably are trying to make here is that having a realistic goal is very important, and actually thinking about that in terms of an actionable way, you know, setting up a goal that has a clear outcome and a pathway to get there is critically important. Because if it's just, I want to look good, there's really little to anchor behavior on.
Yeah. No, that is exactly where I was hoping you would go. I think one issue is, and the reason why I was being a bit vague about, you know, what is optimal body composition is because, you know, beauty is in the eye of the beholder, isn't it? And of course, that also depends on whether you're are you looking in the mirror when you're having that thought? And what we see and what we think is optimal or an ideal is most definitely not necessarily what they think, but also what they see in themselves is probably not what you see in them. And it gets a bit complicated. So it's that initial, I certainly find with my work, with whether it's athletes or regular people, it's establishing what that realistic endpoint actually should be, rather than, you know, treating our goals for body composition a bit like people walking into a hairdresser and saying, I want to look like Brad Pitt. It's just not going to happen, you know. So, you know, obviously for professional athletes, there are certain criteria, you know, whether you're a weight sort of restricted or weight managed type sport or athlete like boxing, UFC, or, you know, or maybe in other areas like dancers, ballet dancers, and so on. You know, there are certain things that will define what those limits are. But even so, those numbers, that criteria, is still nothing compared to what we're judging by the eye, right?
Yes, very much.
And that probably, you know, for all the rocket science we've got, whether it's DEXAs or, you know, hydrostatic weighing, or, you know, even what we can measure through skin fold calipers, and we'll get into all these things in a minute, it's still the visual side of that. And I guess when we talk about optimal body composition, every listener is going to have their own idea about what that means. But ultimately, if we join up all those ideas and construct it into a visual image, that's going to be an interesting image, isn't it? I guess if we were to simplify it, maybe the average, the mean sort of idea amongst everyone is going to be someone who's lean, maybe has enough muscle mass to have some level of sort of athleticism that's visually sort of definable through their musculature, and not having obviously wobbly bits and so on. So if we can be that vague, you know, in the average person who lives in the real world, who isn't a professional athlete necessarily, who is walking around with wobbly bits, you know, where would you see for them, when someone's working with them, or if a listener is listening to this, you know, where is the starting point that they need to, you know, to go from to achieve that ideal?
Well, I would say, you know, if we're going to talk about kind of an average and where they might sit, people like to talk in body fat percentages. And, you know, you could say in the range of, you know, 12 to 15% for males, and, you know, another 7 or 8% higher than that for women, so the low 20s maybe. And that is a generally sustainable place for most people, but not everyone, depending on both behavioral and physiological aspects of them as a person. But I also think it's important when you start setting those initial goals of where you want to get to think about where the person's starting. Because even if 15% was, and on average, a realistic goal, if I was working with someone who was 350 pounds at you know, 5'6", we would probably work on, let's get to 300 first, which would be, you know, an outcome that anyone else would see them after that weight loss and go, wow, you really need to lose some weight. And they would say, well, I know that. I've already lost 50 pounds. But so I think it's very important to set goals along the way and not to just get so focused on the summit of the mountain as to lose track of all the steps you have to take to get there and to appreciate the journey. I would say not. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, do you think because I want to get into this business of percentages and stuff in a second, because I think that's an interesting concept and potentially a dangerous one as well. But do you think, I mean, how important do you think it is for people to goal set it with regards to having that sort of that visual idea as to what they want to achieve rather than a number?
That's a great point. I mean, when it really comes down to it, if someone came to me and they're unhappy with their body composition and they had me do a, you know, full ISAC level one body composition measurement of them, or if, you know, they wanted me to ultrasound them and or dunk tank them or chuck them through a DEXA or whatever, and the numbers spit out, you know, 8% body fat, it wouldn't change their opinion. You know, if they felt that they didn't like the way they looked, they'd be like, well, whatever it says, I want to be leaner, you know. And vice versa. You know, if someone achieved their goal and thought they looked great, and my little magic research machine said, no, you're 25% body fat, that male wouldn't go, oh, well, I guess I look terrible, you know. So I do think, you know, we use the numbers to speak a common language. You know, typically if we're speaking to a fitness audience and we say 15% body fat, they kind of go, okay, so yeah, he's starting to get some outlines of his abs. You know, there's a common language there as to what that's supposed to be. Mm. But with the standard error on these measurements, with the changes in body fat distribution for the person individually, in the reality that we don't actually chase numbers, we chase a look. Yeah, sometimes it's better to actually focus on progress and time frames and intermediate goals rather than I'm going to get to 15% body fat or I'm going to get to X weight. Especially the longer off that goal may be.
Yeah, and I the reason why I'm saying that is because almost every day in my own work, I have people coming in where that is, you know, body composition is a goal, and of course, you know, I say body composition, of course, they're saying weight, and it doesn't matter what the DEXA says, what the skin folds say, because I do ISAC as well. You know, the minute you say, you know, let's say I saw you a month ago and you were, say, 80 kilos and you've come back in the office today and you're still 80 kilos, but, you know, your girth measurements on your arms have gone up a centimeter and your skin folds have gone down, you know, 6 millimeters, or the total sum of your skin folds has gone down X amount, you know, they're still going, yeah, but I still weigh the same. And you can tell that as something that drives their behavior and as something that influences, you know, their judgment on whether they're succeeding or failing, which obviously influences their ability to be compliant to the recommendations that we give as coaches, which is our ultimate strategy, isn't it? Unlike some people who are personal trainers who are lucky to have clients, you know, who work with them and they see them many times per week, is not necessarily the same thing. Like for me as a sports nutritionist, I will see my clients maybe, if I'm lucky, every 2 weeks, but usually once a month. For those that are working with people online, you know, you don't see them at all. So that number that they see on their scale becomes so powerful that even though it's just a little digital digit or a you know, a number that the dial is pointing to, it somehow is more powerful than what they see in the mirror or what you see or what you can demonstrate with those tools. I mean, how do you feel?
It certainly
about that?
Can be. Yeah. I'd say that can be the case. And it can also go the other way. You know, sometimes if the numbers indicate something is happening well, but the mirror does not, and whether it really does or doesn't is the real question, can also get in someone's head. You know, it's interesting. I've seen the opposite with bodybuilders where they need to look a certain way. And, you know, if they're sending in their report to me and, you know, their body weight is down the amount I want and their performance is good and the pictures they send me look good, but they think they look bad, then it almost doesn't matter. You know, and then that becomes its own coaching point. But yeah, like you said, when you're dealing with more general population or athletic personnel, the number can be placed at an incorrect priority. And I think there's probably two sides of that you can affect as a coach, in my opinion. And one is eliminating some of the noise of those numbers. I think in general, if you ask someone to weigh themselves, they'll do it once a week on maybe the same day. But the clothing they wear won't be different. You know, you tell them, hey, your shoes were 2 pounds. And they'll be like, yeah, right. And then you'd be like, no, seriously, go step on the scale, take your shoes off, do it again. And they'll be surprised. And their jeans weigh a couple pounds. Or if they do it in the gym in sweats after they've been sweating and they're, you know, covered in water, and they don't realize how much noisiness there is in their numbers or just the day-to-day fluctuations or what an extra 100 grams of carbohydrate instead of 11 grams of fat will do to their body weight from glycogen retention.
Yeah.
And all these things that we're aware of that will make their measurements go all over the place become the truth. So there is a lot of things you can do, you know, weigh-ins under the same conditions more than one time a week and taking an average, you know, but more important than all that, you can make the numbers look a little better. But like you said, the real coaching point is the way they put it into perspective. And I think it's the role of a good coach, or just a coach, if you're going to use that as your title, in my opinion, to help them contextualize the information coming to them. So that the priorities are put in order. And I would like to think that my career is based around helping athletes and just general people in general, you know, get their priorities straight, because there's so much information out there that it's difficult to do that. And like you said, body composition is, of course, a much higher priority than what the weight says. The weight is just, you know, one piece of information. And if that is not put in the correct priority, and if the coaching isn't in place to help them reframe their perspective, then that can definitely cause more problems than that information can actually help.
Yes, and I think as practitioners, coaches, or people that are in some way involved in, you know, in this assessment and or sort of, you know, directing people with this information and using things like weight and body composition as criteria to determine progress or lack of progress, we need to be very careful about how we handle that information, because the messages, you know, can be interesting and potentially dangerous. And you just mentioned about, you know, the sort of variability of weight, time of day, and so on. I mean, for example, yesterday I did a VO2 max on a athlete, weighed him before the VO2 max. The whole, you know, the test only lasted about 20 minutes, and I weighed him afterwards, and he had lost a kilo just from sweat in a VO2 max. So, that was interesting for him, because he was one of those guys that was freaking out a bit, because his, the weight on the scale for him was his only real criteria to judge whether or not he was progressing or not. And actually the fact that he lost, you know, 2 kilograms or 2.2 pounds just in a 20 minute workout was interesting. So where I want to lead with that is when we talk about body composition, there are various compartments of the body which do fluctuate day to day. Do you want to perhaps just tell us about what those compartments are?
No, yeah, definitely. I think probably the by far the most variable is the water content of the body. Like you said, sweating will influence this. Electrolyte consumption, you know, if you acutely consume a large sodium amount for a few days, your weight will spike, and then as you increase sodium excretion, it'll come back down. You know, foods that stay around in your gut longer and have weight, you know, because the energy content and the weight of food is not necessarily the same. You know, and then that's actually a strategy a lot of dieters use, is they eat a large volume of food with a low calorie content, but that's a still weight in your gut. Electrolyte intake, weight of food, the time of the day you wake up. You know, if while you're asleep and just breathing, you're not drinking water, you're not using the toilet, every time you breathe, you're losing some moisture, you know, from air. So if you weigh yourself right before you go to bed and weigh yourself when you wake up, even though you haven't drank or used the bathroom, you're going to lose probably about 1 to 2% of your body weight by the time you wake up, in water from moisture leaving the lungs. Water weight is a huge amount of fluctuation there, and stress levels driving up cortisol, which increases sodium retention, which increases, you know, body water retention, which increases scale weight, is there as well. So I mean, people will sometimes worry about a 2 pound shift in one day. And I try to explain to them, look, unless you manage to eat 7,000 calories on top of your maintenance, that's probably not fat.
Yeah.
You know? So that's a huge compartment that has an intense amount of variability. And it's funny because this is something I know from being a coach and a personal trainer for years, but researchers, honestly, they pay a lot of attention to the reliability of their measuring equipment, but forget about the reliability of a biological system. Hmm. You know, so you might see a nutritional study, a nutritional intervention that's 4 weeks long with one weigh-in and the beginning and the end. And they lost 4 pounds in one group and say 3 pounds or 2 pounds in the other. And, you know, P greater than 0.05, the 4 pounds group had a better protocol. But come on. I mean, you can have a 2 pound fluctuation, you know, either way. So how do we really know unless you had just a good enough sample size, you know? And that doesn't happen in nutrition studies. You got N7 versus N8 in a sports nutrition study. And then where we have to put confidence in that number. And the reality is, you know, different time of day, different pre-meal, and there's some things you can do to control it, but I think I'd like to see a lot more 7-day averages reported in the research rather than, this scale weighs to the nearest, you know, hundredth of a gram, but the person doesn't, it fluctuates, you know, a full kilo. So it's kind of, you have to think about that.
No, actually, quite a few podcasts have been dedicated to this whole idea about critical thinking and, you know, appraising the evidence and using that appropriately. And you know, you raised a very good point there. As we're talking about body composition and strategies that we are trying to, you know, to incorporate in our interventions are based, for those of us that are evidence-based, we're basing it on evidence. But of course, how reliable is that evidence? And, you know, for example, you know, DEXA is frequently seen as the gold standard, which people will take that as, you know, an absolute fact in terms of, you know, whatever it says is what you are. But of course, that is also influenced by hydration, for example. So when you look at these studies, you see DEXAs being used, but you haven't seen them also assessing hydration status to control for that. So and then at the end of the entire study, which is on very few numbers of people for a very limited period of time, like you say, 7 or 8 people for just a matter of weeks, like a month, in the intervention they lost like 2 or 3 pounds which of course, as I've just said, you could do just from water loss in a 20 minute workout. So how do you know what did what, you know? And I think that's bringing it back to this idea that despite all the gadgets and the numbers that are thrown out at people, when we're talking about body composition as it relates to physique, it's a visual thing. And yes, it doesn't matter what the scale says. If you don't have what you visually see as a pleasing physique or matches the criteria that you need to get up on stage, it's going to be a problem. So, I mean, you know, if we go back to this idea then of body composition from a more idealistic perspective, what we're talking about here is having a, you know, sort of a reasonably significant quantity of muscle mass. And of course, that will vary from just someone who is, I guess, looking to look fit or athletic, as opposed to someone who's wants to look really stacked, you know. But in order to achieve that, Eric, they're going to need to lose body fat. And what they want to do is lose the body fat but maintain the muscle mass or even increase the muscle mass at that time. So this is where we start getting into this idea of, well, okay, so we need to cut the calories, and you've got lots of people have different approaches. Some are very extreme. But for those that are looking to lose fat but keep the muscle or gain the muscle, what is the most important criteria to achieve that?
I think it starts with education, just to help them kind of understand what they're shooting at. So, you know, if we kind of follow the trail of our conversation, we've helped this theoretical client get a good idea of where they want to get to, highly influenced by their own aesthetic, you know, ideal, and we've put that into some kind of type of tangible, time regimented approach with you know, some way to get there, and hopefully along the way we've educated them a little bit about, you know, energy balance and potentially about how to track that. That's probably the most important thing, is to understand how a biological system gains and loses mass. And if they can understand that, then we can talk to them about, okay, well, what are the things we can do to make sure that the mass we lose is fat mass, and the mass we keep or even gain, as you said, especially with a beginner, which is very possible, is lean body mass or in muscle. And so if they've got that down, you know, the first things they need to learn is how do I accurately track my food intake? Doesn't necessarily need to be something they do forever, but, you know, weighing and tracking and counting calories and getting an idea of looking at food and seeing the energy value at the very least is very important. So educating them on how to understand what's going in, and then also teaching them some fundamentals of resistance training, which is arguably the most powerful tool for maintaining lean body mass in a diet and potentially gaining it if we're talking about someone who's in a novice, because that will be a novel stimulus that will be powerful enough to put on lean body mass even if they're in a calorie deficit. You know, teaching them the fundamentals of resistance training, teaching them about energy balance, and then potentially doing some very simple manipulations to their diet based on what their baseline is. And probably one of the most important would just be trying to increase their protein intake to something more appropriate for someone who is going to be in an energy restricted state, weight training, and trying to put on lean body mass. So maybe something closer to 2 times the RDA instead of the RDA, or a little bit higher, if they find that that helps with, you know, satiation.
Yeah, and you know, and that's an angle, of course, which we've covered both with you and Alan, and many of the other guests. But you've just mentioned something actually that I think is well worth exploring a bit here, and it's this idea of, in order to put this into practice, we have to have an idea, a very good idea, as to how much we actually should be eating and how much we shouldn't be eating. And that sort of gets into something that isn't talked about enough, and that is how we actually track this stuff in the real world. Not everyone is a scientist or has access to, you know, doubly labeled water or, you know, calorimeters or 24-hour calorimeters, you know, that's what people talk about. But the average person doesn't even know what a calorie is or how much a gram of protein is. In fact, what is a gram of protein? Because, so you know, someone will think chicken is a protein as opposed to being a food that's rich in protein, or someone will look at green peas as being a vegetable, but is it really a carbohydrate, or what is it? So just from a more pragmatic perspective, you know, this idea of tracking, which is something your clients have to get very good at to get to the levels that they do. What are the most important things that you've learned about tracking?
Yeah, well, step one is just to simply have the person start looking at their nutrition labels and logging when they eat, what they eat, how much they eat, and then once they get comfortable doing that, I would say even add on, you know, how they felt about eating it, how full they were, and this is more for behavior change rather than just learning about energy balance, and then also eventually writing down the macronutrient and the calorie count. And probably in the opposite order, you know, calories first and then learning where those calories come from. But yeah, you know, once someone has gotten, say, a week or two under their belt of weighing and measuring and tracking and logging and writing, they'll learn a couple things. They'll learn, what am I normally doing? Where are there easy places for me to change my behaviors? How much are these behaviors actually a problem? You know, once I learn the energy count of these things I'm eating, and I take a look at my diet and I get an idea of my macronutrient breakdown, and I see, oh, maybe this is why I'm hungry all the time. I have very little fiber and very little protein in my diet, and it's largely simple carbohydrates and high fat items. Or perhaps they find some things about themselves behaviorally, about when they eat and what drives them to overeat. And it starts to unravel potential pathways to behavior change for them. So yeah, logging, tracking, and learning how to count and figuring out their relationship with food is extremely important, and it's the first step. And often just tracking and measuring typically makes people improve their behavior. They end up being kind of their own police, because everyone at least generally has an idea of maybe when they're overeating or what might be a quote-unquote junk food or a good food, and they typically start to modify their behavior, and all those unconscious behaviors, like just kind of grabbing a donut at work that was, you know, left out, or, you know, taking little candies that are sitting at the receptionist's office while you wait for your doctor's appointment, et cetera, et cetera. All of a sudden, now they have to think about that and write it down, and those behaviors get a second, basically, awareness instead of just the unconscious, subconscious one, and they might actually not do it. So, you know, you typically have someone start tracking, and you don't actually know it's not actually their maintenance the first time they do it. They start to lose weight if they're very green to this process. And that in and of itself can be an intervention in some cases.
Yeah. So if we're to tie in this tracking to body composition, obviously, you know, you're not going to be able to see that on a daily basis necessarily. But do you feel that it's worth establishing some sort of link between what we're tracking and what we're observing in body composition? And by that, I mean perhaps establishing maybe some baseline assessments, and there's varying levels that those assessments could be, depending on, of course, what technology or facilities or resources the individual, the coach, has. Where, you know, do you see a link between the two?
Definitely. I mean, in the simplest form, I'll have someone who's relatively new to this get a MyFitnessPal account, spend a week eating normally and tracking it and just writing it down so they can see, and teaching them how to effectively use MyFitnessPal. There is a little bit of a curve there since it's a user-generated database, and that's as simple as double-checking, you know, the things you look up on Google, because you can get the USDA values for most foods. In any way, then just tracking for a week while measuring body weight on a day-to-day basis, or 2 weeks. And then you can just see, okay, what did my body weight do over 2 weeks on average if I compare the first 7 day average to the second 7 day average, and what was my 7 day average calorie intake for week one and week two? And then you can establish basically whether they're in a surplus, a deficit, or roughly around maintenance. And then from there, if you did your job teaching them how to use a food scale and measuring cups with some relative accuracy, you can start making adjustments. And even if they were off, if they were consistently off, no big deal. You know, if they were eating, 3,000 calories, but they wrote down 2,700, you're going to make your calorie adjustment as a practitioner from 2,700. And sure, let's say you drop 500, you tell them to eat 22, they're actually eating 25, but it's the same deficit, you know?
Yeah, it's very... Actually, something I'm particularly interested in is how much faith we put into those numbers. And I know we need to have something to control our behavior and to help, you know, give us a ballpark sort of, you know, an idea of what we're eating. Because most people, as I mentioned, they haven't got a clue what they're eating. So I see that as a great tool. But I'm actually working on a study right now, which I'm hoping to publish soon, which... In my own lab, we do a hell of a lot of metabolic testing. And one thing that's absolutely clear is the massive amount of variability between individuals. Particularly, one area I'm interested in is the relevance of resting metabolic rate. Because, of course, most people aren't active most of the time. They're resting most of the time. So that number, you know, which is loosely related also to their BMR, their basal metabolic rate, is that number that is usually sort of auto-generated by the software system. And that, of course, is an estimate based on, you know, whatever sort of formula they're using, Harris Benedict or whatever. And, of course, what the user doesn't actually realize, of course, is that the number that it's telling you, let's say 2,000 calories for a man or 1,500 calories for a woman, is just the average. But you as an individual, your actual needs may vary considerably. And in my own study, for example, my own observations in my lab, we're seeing, you know, as much as 500 calories either side, sometimes more, but it's quite commonly, you know, you could be your RMR or BMR could be 500 calories more or 500 calories less than the estimate, which really does change things a little bit. And I guess for some people, those numbers are pretty accurate, but for some people they're not. And you will see people getting extremely upset and emotional because they are weighing their foods, they're counting their calories, and they're still not getting the results, i.e. fat loss or muscle gain, without necessarily realizing that actually the numbers that they're aiming to achieve or to hit are not necessarily the right numbers for them, and therefore we maybe should bear that in mind if we're not necessarily getting the results that we want. You know, is that something that you feel is relevant, really, or is it perhaps just I'm just, you know, it's maybe just being overly focused?
No, I think the point that you made that some of these calculations are highly inaccurate for individuals is extremely important, because like I said, you know, I could plug in Harris Benedict or any other number of the TDEE or BMR based calculations for individuals, but I never do that. I always prefer to teach them how to track and have them get real world data, because that is going to be scaled to them. And you know, RMR does have a large variability, as you're finding out and have just expressed from your lab's data, and other compartments of TDE have a huge amount of variability as well. Not so much, you know, TEF or the energy expenditure during exercise, but one of the largest components to metabolic adaptation, which will come from dieting or overeating, is non-exercise activity thermogenesis. You know, NEAT, that's the subconscious fidgeting, that's the efficiency of skeletal muscle, and that is general, how much time do you spend being sedentary or not. And that has a huge capacity to adapt. And there is one or two studies in obese individuals where one group given a certain deficit and the other group given twice that deficit lost the same amount of weight and then stopped, because in one group, NEAT was completely made up for by, or sorry, the deficit was completely made up for by a reduction in NEAT. And things like changes in postural control and skeletal muscle efficiency won't even be picked up by things like accelerometers or, you know, what's commonly seen as the body bug. So the point being is that TDEE, total daily energy expenditure, can vary greatly between individuals for not only the RMR component that you've talked about, but also activity, both passive and active and subconscious at the macro level and completely uncontrollable at the micro level, such as skeletal muscle efficiency. And there's been studies where they take someone who's lost weight and they replace the lost weight on the limb and have them move the limb, and it still burns less calories, because at the most basic level in the muscle cell, it has become more efficient. So, yeah, I mean, the difference, you know, there's some papers out there that talk about the difference between thrifty and spendthrift, you know, phenotypes. And, you know, people who essentially, you know, the ice age happens and they'll be okay, and the other people who the ice age happens and they'll die in a couple months, you know. So yeah, I would say that always you want to be working off of real-world data, and if you can't get that for some reason, then sure, you can ballpark it with some of these equations, but they are going to be estimations at best.
Yeah, and I'm pleased you said what you said, because, you know, the reason why I'm mentioning this is because we're constantly getting into the rocket science and we're talking about body composition as it relates to measurements from, you know, rocket science equipment like DEXAs, and, you know, where we can all argue about the relative benefits of skin folds, you know, whether it's ISAC or ACSM or whatever, or, you know, girth measurements or whatever. But at the end of the day, the visual assessment is perhaps the more accurate one. But obviously that's controversial because it depends on what you see and whether or not there's any issues with, you know, body dysmorphia and all those sorts of things. But body composition is an important topic that isn't discussed enough in these research studies. And yes, there are numbers we might strive to achieve if we're trying to hit a certain weight or a certain target. But for all the sort of sciencey manipulation of setting targets, and of course, in order to get there, we need to have something. to get us there. But we should also have respect for the fact that, you know, we live in the real world, and we, you know, and if you're feeling rotten and you're craving, you know, foods like crazy, and you're fatigued, and your performance outcomes, you know, you just can't lift anymore, or you just can't move your legs, you know, you're possibly taking those numbers to an extreme, and you need to have respect for the fact that yeah, like you said, that there's a degree of inaccuracy, which is hidden by, well, I mean, it's dressed up to be accurate, isn't it? It looks accurate, but it isn't. So it's that, yeah, learning.
It's accurate for a population.
Yeah, yeah. And where the hell do we fit in that population? I mean, in a population of individuals. And I find that fascinating. And of course, you know, we're really having a conversation here that could go on for years, and will be in the literature. I just wanted to talk about body composition because people will constantly talk about weight loss or weight gain, and I think it's important that you know that we got into this. I mean, look, you know, we're sort of more or less out of time here, but you know, just as sort of a more final sort of summing up, then perhaps, you know, for those that are looking to take their body composition to a more serious level, there are a number of things that they need to take very seriously. Clearly, they need to take their nutrition seriously. They need to take their training seriously. But perhaps, and I'm thinking you'll agree with me on this, they also need to take this, what I'm about to say, very seriously. And that is, this is possibly something you don't want to do on your own. You might want to get some help, be it some solid advice and recommendations from someone, or get some coaching help throughout that process, because trying to do this stuff on your own can be quite a treacherous journey. I mean, how, you know, what would your advice be to people in that regard?
Well, I'll make a point by saying that when I diet down for a show, I have coaches. And that's someone who has been coaching for his career. You know, it's very difficult to be objective when you're dealing with something like this. You know, if you think about it, it's unethical for a therapist or a doctor to treat a family member because they have a biased relationship. They're unable to be objective because there's a certain level of emotional closeness, right?
Yeah.
But who are we emotionally closer to than ourselves? Who are we not more biased than, except for our own perspective? So, you know, being a coach or a practitioner is not about your level of knowledge. That is a component. But the main purpose of it is to help someone gain objectivity and to make decisions that will benefit them from a logical place, not one that is biased by their emotions, their stress, their desires, their fears. And we all fall victim to this because we're all human. And I make silly decisions that I would never make with a client. When I'm shredded and have to get on stage in a Speedo with a dodgy tan, like you said, with, you know, my competitive, you know, career on the line, and I need someone to give me that objective perspective. And it doesn't necessarily need to be a formal coach, but it needs to be someone who has some type of experience with this, knows the target to aim at, and can give you feedback along the way and help you make those assessments. So I would agree.
I think Eric, anybody who gets up on stage in skimpy Speedos in a dodgy tan is making a bad decision. I do find it amusing. I mean, it's a very serious ambition for a lot of people. That there is an explosion of these competitions, you know, like Miami Pro, for example. There's so many of them now.
Yeah. Well, I've definitely been a chronic bad decision maker. I've been on stage 9 times, you know.
Wow. Yeah. Well, I think that's great training for you to help other people as a coach. You know, I think having had that experience makes you a better coach. You know, I typically don't work with that population on my own. I work as part of a team when we work with physique athletes and bodybuilders, because I personally haven't stepped up on stage, and I don't think I will be. So anyway, listen, Eric, it's been great to have you.
And that's okay.
Yeah, no, it is okay. Trust me, it's for the better of the world generally. Look, it's been great. It's been great to have you on board, all the way from New Zealand. For the listeners, there's sort of a slight delay between our various questions and answers on this, but on the whole, I think it's been brilliant to have you on board once again and to discuss these things, Eric. And I look forward to reading more of your research as it comes out. I know you're going to be pumping out some more. For those that haven't listened to your other podcast, which we got into a lot more science in that one, I recommend the listeners do go to that. I don't have the number there, but it was with Alan Aragon. Could you let the listeners know how to find out more about you, like your website and Twitter and that sort of thing, if you do Twitter?
Definitely. So our website is www.3dmusclejourney.com. That's the number 3, the letter D, and then Muscle Journey, spelled normally. You can also find me on Facebook, and I believe my profile is Eric R. Helms, E-R-I-C-R-H-E-L-M-S. And then I don't tweet, but I do have a ResearchGate account if you want to get all nerdy. So I have also the same profile, Eric R. Helms, on ResearchGate. And you can take a look at all the publications that I currently have out. And that is probably the. And then also we have a YouTube account where the four of us coaches put out videos, and I tend to do, for those science geeks out there, much more science kind of focused, evidence-based videos. And that is youtube.com/team3dmj, the number 3 and the letters DMJ. And you can find all of our videos there. And I've done a 3 series that you're probably most interested in. That's the Muscle and Strength Nutritional Pyramid, Peeling Back a Layer, and then also the Muscle and Strength Training Pyramid, which I'm halfway through right now.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah, no, the first one was brilliant. I saw that. It's highly recommended. So listen, mate, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
I know it's really late at night.
Thank you.
Now, your time. And that brings us to the end of this podcast. And I, of course, am Lauren Bannock. You can learn more about the podcast at guruperformance.com, and I look forward to bringing another one to you all very soon.